And I've got Bill Burns, my co-author in the book Worker in the Light, working on college credit for Coast to Coast. He's been talking to a lot of people, for example, in the California Department of Education, about getting credit for listening to the program. And he's inching his way forward, getting there, baby steps, but he's getting there. Tonight's show would be 4 credits. I guarantee it. We'll be back in a moment with our guest, Marcus Chone, on Coast to Coast AM. Marcus Chone, our guest. We're talking about his book, The Quantum Zoo. Marcus, so many things to talk with you about. I want to come back to parallel realities. A lot of people are interested in that. You write some great things. You kind of remind me of a television character we used to have here years ago called Mr. Wizard, who would conduct some experiments on television that were pretty darn interesting for people. And the book reads that way. It's pretty understandable, and I think that's good because though we all need the education, you speak in terms that are understandable.
Well, I write to my wife, who's a nurse, and she has no science background whatsoever. So if she can't understand it, she tells me. So that's the kind of people that I'm trying to write for, you know, ordinary people rather than actual specialists.
So you ready for a silly question?
Ask me a silly question.
I know that when the sun goes down, the sky gets dark. I know when the sun comes up on a clear day, the sky looks blue. Why? Why is it dark? Why does it look blue?
Well, 2 questions there. I mean, they both have big answers, really. But the fact that the sky is dark at night is a 400-year-old mystery. Most people don't realize this. They think, well, the sky is dark at night because the sun's not in the sky. But actually, the first person to realize that this was actually a puzzle was the Polish astronomer Johann Kepler, about 400 years ago, because he thought to himself, well, if this universe goes on forever, then, you know, there are nearby stars, and beyond those are, you know, further away stars, fainter, and beyond those, even fainter stars. The situation is rather like looking into a pine forest. You know, if you look into a pine forest, you see tree trunks near you. Between them, you see further away tree trunks. Between them, you see even further away tree trunks. So basically, all you see are tree trunks. You don't see any gaps at all. Okay, so Kepler said, when you look out at the sky, you should just see stars. You shouldn't see any gaps. The sky shouldn't be dark at night. It should be white. It should be actually, it should be like the surface of the average star or sun. But of course, it isn't. It's trillions of times fainter. It's actually black. Now, we've only discovered the answer to this mystery in the last about 30 years. And it really is, the answer is that the universe had a beginning. You know, it began 14 billion years ago. So although there are, you know, the universe may go on infinitely and there may be stars beyond the stars, beyond the stars forever, we can only see the nearby ones because all the ones that are further away, their light just hasn't had enough time to get here
yet. As some of these stars that were seen, they could be gone by now.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the nearest star is Alpha Centauri, and we're seeing it as it was 4 years ago. So we're seeing it as it was in 2002. I mean, it's unlikely that Alpha Centauri would have actually blown up because it's actually a pretty stable star.
But maybe something way out there.
But the furthest thing that you can see with the naked eye is the Andromeda galaxy. I mean, we live in a group of galaxies called the Local Group. It's only got 2 big members. One's the Milky Way where we live, and there's this kind of twin called the Andromeda galaxy. And you can see the Andromeda galaxy with a naked eye, you know, if you're away from a city. We're seeing that as it was about 2 million years ago. And then when we look at the most distant objects in the universe, we're seeing them as they were 10 billion years ago. So they certainly don't exist anymore. For instance, if I can give you an idea, some of the brightest objects in the universe, well, we've actually discovered some of the brightest objects in the universe are quasars, things called quasars. And these are just the disturbed hearts of newborn galaxies. We think they contain supermassive black holes, and they're fantastically bright, so we can see them to enormous distances. There are no quasars near us. They're all dead. we're seeing, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when we look at quasars, it's kind of like looking at Roman legionnaires. You know, there are no Roman legionnaires around, but you know, it's as if we get the after image of Roman legionnaires. You know, there are no quasars around because they're all dead.
Well, you got to listen to some of our ghost stories where people have seen Roman legionnaires marching through their basement.
My God, what, in America?
Yeah.
Isn't that a bit peculiar?
I mean, I
don't think the Romans got to America, did they?
I didn't think so either. Well, the whole thing is remarkable because it's exciting, yet at the same time, it is so perplexing. And you see science coming up with more and more answers every day. I mean, just last week, scientists have announced that the satellite that's on its way to Pluto may give them an answer. And exactly what you've been talking about, Marcus, they're beginning to think that our universe, is a bubble within another universe. And they think that this satellite is going to give them some of the answers. Now, that's incredible.
Well, it is incredible, but, you know, I mean, we are in a very, very exciting time, you know, where we're discovering new things, and we do really feel that the observable universe is a kind of bubble in a far larger universe. And there is a very popular theory called inflation, which actually explains what happened in the first split second of the universe, which is tagged on to the Big Bang theory. And people kind of, when they talk about the Big Bang theory, they mean the Big Bang plus inflation now. And in inflation, the universe is very probably infinite. So beyond our little bubble, which contains all the stars and galaxies we can see, there are probably an infinite number of other bubbles. So, it is a very exciting universe. What's most exciting is there are a lot of things that don't fit. Now, I told you about this dark energy, which accounts for 73% of the mass of the universe. Now, that's very interesting because every chunk of empty space contains this mysterious dark energy. Now, we have our best theory, which is one of the things I talk about in my book, Quantum Theory, predicts what the energy of empty space should be. And that theory predicts the energy, and it's 1 followed by 123 zeros bigger than what we observe. So that our best theory, I mean, can you imagine 1 followed by 123 zeros? That's a big number. That's how discrepant it is with what we observe. That is the biggest discrepancy between a theory and observation in the history of science. So on the one hand, yeah, we've made fantastic progress in understanding the universe. We know that many of the basic building blocks are quarks and things like this, and we can see to the edge of the universe. On the other hand, there's these baffling things that have been thrown at us, you know, since 1998, this dark energy, and physicists are totally at sea. And this is why, before the break, we were talking about what's going to come next. Well, we need a big new idea. You know, there needs to be someone like Einstein or somebody coming along with a big new idea because physics is in need of it.
And that's got to be some kind of propulsion throughout the universe or to these multiverses. Somebody's going to come up with something that will allow us to travel in interstellar space at remarkable speeds at the snap of a finger. That's going to be it, I think.
Well, that is possible. That is possible. Who knows? Who knows what's around the corner? I mean, if you had someone from the 19th century trying to predict what we have today, you know, television, I mean, they think that was magic. Airliners, they think that was magic. I mean, the internet, I mean, it'd be inconceivable. I mean, if you showed someone from 1900 a chunk of silicon, if they were a chemist, they might say, oh, you know, maybe that's the element silicon. They wouldn't know that comes from a computer that's a chip, and it's got to be gold in or whatever, and that can actually do billions of calculations a second. Who knows what's around the corner?
Well, show them a moon rock. Tell them a man went up there, grabbed it, and came back.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I suppose people like Jules Verne kind of imagine that, but some of the things we have are just amazing. I mean, Arthur C. Clarke, the British science fiction writer who lives in Sri Lanka, has said that any sufficiently advanced civilization would be indistinguishable from magic. How the hell? I mean, you know, we have SETI at the moment, a search for extraterrestrial intelligence, and we're kind of looking for technologies that are rather at our level. I mean, you know, we use radio waves, so we look out and we think, oh, well, let's see if we can pick up some radio waves. So, you know, the equivalent of interstellar radio station, or we use laser beams. Let's see if someone out there's flashing a laser beam at us. But, I mean, you know, a civilization that's 100 years ahead of us would be totally unrecognizable. We wouldn't be able to you know, that they could be out there at the moment, and we just wouldn't know the signs.
I had a guest Monday, Patrick Heron, he's from Dublin, and he says that SETI has information that they're just not telling us about yet, that they've picked up signals from outer space that are intelligent. And I'm thinking to myself, no, if they had this, I think they'd go wild with it because it would increase their budget. But he's convinced they have it. We've had guests on who say, no, they thought they had a blip a long time ago, but it turned out not to be.
Well, that's actually right. I mean, it turns out that SETI has been going for about 40-odd years, and there have been lots of blips. Lots and lots. I mean, the most famous was what's called the WOW signal.
The WOW, that's right.
Which was 1977, Ohio State radio telescope there. They were just pointing at a particular star, and they had a pen recorder on a bit of paper then. It wasn't really sophisticated like today's computers, and it just went off scale. And someone just scrawled WOW across it, you know. And it lasted, I can't remember how long it lasted. It was probably about 40 seconds or something like that. But the problem is it never repeated. You know, the problem with the signals that have been found is they've never repeated. And unless they repeat, you know, we can't be sure that they aren't just some glitch in the machinery or something like that. But, you know, I mean, it could be we've only just scraped the surface. Remember, there are 100,000 million stars in our own galaxy. And only a small fraction of those have we actually looked at, you know, for an intelligent signal.
And we're beginning to find planets.
Well, that is an incredibly exciting thing, because really, I'm trying to think now, the first planet was only discovered around another star 10 years ago.
And now they're
170.
Yeah, exactly. And now they're beginning to find Earth-sized planets. Before, they were just the big ones. They're beginning to see, you know, like the shadows of another planet going across its star. Yeah. Or something like that, and I think it's just a matter of time where they're going to pinpoint Earth-like planets. They're going to beam these signals. They may not, you know, communicate the way we have, but I got to tell you, Marcus, I believe there's life out there. I think the universe is teeming with intelligent life.
I do as well, but I think it might be very difficult for us to recognize it. I mean, you know, we're talking about you know, not recognizing a technology even 100 years ahead, that might be very difficult. But it's more likely that any other civilizations out there will be millions of years or even billions of years ahead of us.
Do you think it's been here?
Does an ant walking around, you know, Manhattan know that it's actually walking on the sidewalk in a city that's connected to other cities by communications, by the internet, by phone? It's got no idea, has it? And what about a bacterium? What does a bacterium know about human civilization? And I think we might be in the position of like bacteria or even ants. You know, it might be impossible for us to recognize that there's a glaring sign in the sky tonight that extraterrestrials are out there, but we just don't know. We just can't recognize it.
Do you believe we've already been visited, though? Some people do. I'm beginning to wonder if our civilization wasn't seeded by intelligent extraterrestrials. There have been a number of theories on that. Possibility?
Well, it's a possibility. I tell you something that's probably happened, and that is their space garbage has actually come our way. Because if you think...
And give me your definition of their space garbage.
Yeah, I tell you. You know, there's a lot of junk in space. We call it space junk. You know, NASA tracks about 11,000 bits of space junk orbiting the Earth that are bigger than a baseball, you know, and these things are a real danger, and the space shuttle has to be diverted, you know, if anything, or, you know, if it's going to be anywhere near one of these bits of junk. Where do these bits of junk come from? And there's millions and millions of bits of junk the size of like a pencil lead, you know, that kind of diameter. Where do these bits of junk come from? Well, you know, they're discarded rocket casings. There have been explosions on satellites. There have been collisions. There are bits of junk thrown out by manned missions. You know, I won't go into details. You know, human effluent, that kind of stuff. Now, a lot of when there's collisions between this stuff or explosions, some of this stuff actually gets ejected from our solar system. And there's a Russian astronomer called Alexei Arkhipov, and he said, well, if our junk you know, sails off to the stars, what about their junk? You know, if there are technological civilizations around nearby stars, same kind of accidents are going to happen to them, and their space junk's going to come here. And he puts in some figures, and he says, well, maybe, say we say that 1 in 10,000 stars in our galaxy has a technological civilization during its lifetime, and they convert a certain amount of their raw material, you know, their iron or whatever, you know, into artifacts, and some of it gets ejected. How much would have fallen to Earth? And he works out that you would expect something like 4,000 objects the size of a peanut butter jar on the Earth. That's how many the Earth would have accumulated in 4.6 billion years it existed. Now, of course, if it turns out that technological civilizations are 10 times rarer than that, then it would only be 400, you know. So his point is that the alien junk, if there are alien civilizations in our universe, their garbage must have come our way. The problem with the Earth, of course, is we have weather, we have geology, you know, everything gets worn away. However, next to us, we've got the moon, you know, where there hasn't been any geology, any weather for 4 billion years. You know, that's the place to look. And it's no accident, I suppose, that in the movie 2001, Arthur C. Clarke put the alien artifact, the monolith, on the moon.
Yeah, good point. Good point. By the way, I stand corrected. I said it was my guest Patrick Heron who talked about SETI finding signals. It was Stephen Greer.
Oh.
My webmaster has reminded me from my feeble memory. I am 56 now, Marcus. Things are beginning to slip a little bit from me.
Well, I'm 47 today.
Did you see the movie Contact?
I did. Yeah, that was Jodie Foster.
Jodie, right? Which had a little SETI influence in it, where they picked up that signal. What'd you think of the movie?
Great movie. I do remember it was set at Socorro, wasn't it, in New Mexico, where the very large array is. Or, you know, that array of, like, I think it's about 27 radio dishes in the desert there in Socorro. Spectacular sight. But I remember the interesting thing there is that the alien message was actually in a natural number that describes our universe. You know, the number pi, which is the ratio of the circumference of a circle to its diameter. And, you know, we've worked out like a billion digits of pi. And as we work out more and more digits, they appear to be random. But Sagan suggested that when we got to, like, you know, digit 10 billion or whatever, it would stop being random. And we get like a whole string of zeros and a whole string of ones. And this was a message. So that's a fantastic idea that our universe might contain messages in the fundamental constants. I mean, obviously, that would require the universe to have been built or, you know, assembled by somebody. And they're going to have left a message in the universe.
In everything you've covered as a broadcaster and award-winning writer and also as a cosmologist consultant, what fascinates you the most? There's so many different topics out there, but there's got to be that one thing that you just love. What's your passion?
What's my passion? You put me on the spot. That's very difficult.
That's my job.
My passion is cosmology and the origin of the universe, really, because I just think people are switched off by science. I mean, I was when I was at school.
You think
know,
so?
High school.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, because unfortunately it's taught in a very boring manner. But when you tell people that it's actually about origins, you know, it's actually about where we come from, where the Earth came from, where the universe came from, virtually everyone's interested because most people want to know that. You know, they want to know that. So I don't know. I mean, I'm very lucky because I'm a science journalist and I see interesting scientific papers that are published, and I get to call, you know, telephone whoever's written them. And I get to pick the brains of the best people. That's what I really like doing. So I'm always learning new things, and I'm always excited by it.
So what do you think's beyond the edge of the universe, way out there?
Well, we've actually, you know, we've just mentioned that, but it's actually more of the same. It appears to be more of the same.
It just goes on and on and on and on.
Yeah, yeah. But where it just goes on and on and on, as I say, there's more over the horizon of the observable universe, and if we wait another year, more stuff will come over the horizon.
I think so, too. Well, there's more for us to come on and on and on as well, Marcus. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. They used to call me that in St. Louis. Hey, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to chat with Marcus. about these wonderful things going on in the universe. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Marcus, if someone wins a Nobel Science Prize, what do you think it will be for? In the field of astronomy and space.
Well, very few. There isn't actually a prize for astronomy, although actually a few people that have actually made astronomical discoveries have won the physics prize. Like the people who discovered the afterglow of the Big Bang, they got it, and some people who've actually made discoveries about things like pulsars. I would think, well, I don't know, gamma ray bursters, possibly. I mean, these are the biggest bangs in the universe, which were, I don't know, they were picked up by military satellites in the late sort of 60s and, well, I think 1970s.
They could get us, too, by the way, if they hit us.
Yeah, you know, and they were classified for, I think, at least 10 years. The satellites were really looking for clandestine Russian nuclear tests, so they were looking for gamma rays produced by nuclear fireballs. Fortunately, they could discriminate, and when they picked up these gamma ray bursts about once a day, they could at least discriminate and knew they were coming from space. Otherwise, it might have started the Third World War. But anyway, only recently, in the last like five years or so, have we actually been able to identify these objects, because you get a burst of gamma rays, which lasts for a very short time, and you've got to turn your telescope to have a look at it quickly. And we've seen these afterglows, and we've seen the galaxies in which these objects are blowing up in, and they're very, very distant galaxies that existed in the very early universe. And we don't quite know what these objects are, but they are hugely more powerful than supernovae, which are the biggest explosions. They could involve the birth of black holes or the collision of neutron stars, or maybe they're just very energetic supernovae. But as you point out, one of the characteristics of these objects is that they beam their radiation, their gamma rays, in one direction, like a lighthouse. And if you happen to be staring down that beam, I mean, it would be catastrophic for the Earth. If one happened within maybe a few thousand light years of the Earth, it could wipe out life on Earth.
It could destroy
the ozone layer. The fortunate thing that has been discovered in the last few months, it's small statistics at the moment, but it does appear that the galaxies in which these objects go off are not like our Milky Way. They tend to be galaxies with not as many heavy elements, you know, things like iron and calcium and oxygen, as our galaxy. So, you know, that's kind of reduced the risk. It's maybe that these things have not gone off recently in our galaxy. But, you know, it's possible early on in the history of our galaxy, when, you know, the heavy elements are made with time, there weren't so many heavy elements, these things might have happened. And it's possible they could have been responsible for some mass extinctions on the Earth. There's a lot of dangerous things out there.
Physicists say that they believe the universe is growing, that it's expanding. How do we know that to be the case? Maybe the objects within the universe are merely just going out and out and out.
Well, the two things are very, very similar, really. The universe is expanding. We've known this since about the 1930s, when Edwin Hubble, the Californian astronomer in California, discovered that the majority of galaxies, and he was only looking at nearby galaxies, were flying away from us. You know, and there were very few coming towards us. And as we've looked at more and more of the universe, we found that virtually everything is flying away from us. You know, it really is like there really are like pieces of cosmic shrapnel. You know, so the universe is expanding, but it's not expanding into anything. This is what people don't understand. The universe is just basically the gaps between the galaxies are increasing because the universe we don't believe has got an edge. It's not actually expanding into anything. The Big Bang is a misnomer. It's kind of it creates a picture in your mind, and in every way that picture is wrong. For instance, a Big Bang is an explosion, right? Now, if we have imagine an explosion of a piece of dynamite, you know, the dynamite is at a particular point, you know, I don't know, wherever you put it down on the ground, and the shrapnel, you know, expands outwards into pre-existing air. Well, the Big Bang did not happen at any single point, like an explosion of dynamite, and there was nothing pre-existing. Because in the Big Bang, everything was created. Space, time, matter and energy. There was absolutely nothing before. And the expansion started everywhere simultaneously. This is really difficult for people to get their heads around.
Well, it is. Here's an example. If I fly from Los Angeles to St. Louis, I'm traveling away from people in Los Angeles. Yet the size of this country hasn't expanded. So no. Why can't we use this same equation for, you know, galaxies and stars that are moving away from us, but maybe the universe is not expanding?
Well, I mean, the two words are interchangeable. You know, the only things that we see in the universe are galaxies and empty space. That's all we see. So we see the galaxies apparently flying apart, and you can kind of think of them as flying apart, like your, you know, airplane you're flying on, or the universe expanding, you know. But they're very much equivalent ways of looking at it. But the way we, you know, because people think, well, where did the Big Bang happen? You know, where did the explosion happen? And it didn't happen anywhere. It happened everywhere simultaneously. And then the only way I can think of explaining it is to think of like raisins in a cake. You know, imagine that the raisins are, say you were small enough to sit on a raisin in a cake that's rising in an oven. If you were sitting on one raisin and you looked out at the other raisins, you'd see them all moving away from you. But then if you sat on another raisin, you would actually see the same view. So even though we think that everything is flying away from us in the universe, or we can see it flying away from us, if we were to sit on another galaxy anywhere, we would see exactly the same view. From every galaxy, the view is the same. Everything is flying away from everything else. Now, if you think you can't get your head around that, that's because it isn't actually possible for you to imagine it, because the universe is a four-dimensional thing. And therefore, and the Big Bang was an event in four-dimensional space-time. And it's actually fundamentally impossible for you to actually get your head around it, because you're a three-dimensional creature. You can't imagine it. So all you can ever get are glimpses. You know, you can get, I can give you one analogy of a cake, or I can say, imagine the galaxies to be drawn on the surface of a balloon that's inflated, you know, and they all move apart from each other. But I can't ever give you the full picture. Because the full picture, you can't possibly imagine. I can't possibly imagine. It can only be described by the mathematics of Einstein's theory of gravity.
Do you think the universe could be like an accordion, in that it expands, it contracts, it blows up like the Big Bang, it expands, it contracts, and it's just been doing this since, well, I guess, indefinitely?
That was a very popular idea in the 1950s. You know, that there was maybe before the Big Bang the universe had contracted from a former state down to the Big Bang, and then expanded in the Big Bang. And in the future, the expansion will run out of steam, and it will contract down, and there'll be another to a big, what we call a big crunch, and then another Big Bang. But there are various reasons why that could never be true, and therefore the idea was abandoned. Hmm. However, there's a modern version of it which is subtly different.
How so?
And it's called, this is very interesting, because it gives us an explanation for the first time of what the Big Bang was. Because, I mean, we talk about the Big Bang theory, and it turns out that we don't actually know what drove the Big Bang, what actually was the Big Bang, or what happened before.
You know,
we talk about it as if we know everything about it, but we don't actually know the fundamental things about it. But we're talking about string theory, and in string theory, we have the little tiny little vibrating one-dimensional strings as the basic building blocks of everything, you know, us, stars, everything. But it turns out within the theory, you can actually get more complicated objects. So you can have like membranes, two-dimensional membranes, you know, that can vibrate like a trampoline. You can get three-dimensional objects that can vibrate. You can get all kinds of things. So this has actually led to the speculation that our universe itself may actually be a four-dimensional object called a brain within this 10-dimensional space. So then you think, well, actually, it's kind of like an island floating in a higher dimensional ocean, if you like. So then the minute you think about it, you think, well, wait a minute, could it be the only island? There's bound to be other islands out there. So there are people at Princeton and Cambridge in Britain who've speculated that maybe our Big Bang occurred when two of these islands, two of these brains collided in the past.
That I could understand.
So you know, because you think, well, where did the energy from to create the Big Bang come from? Well, it's just like the energy of two trains, you know, two freight trains. They hit each other head on.
Or two planets.
Absolutely. And then the energy of that, you know, the energy of motion is converted into the you know, the energy of the collision, the twisted metal, the noise, the whatever. Well, in this view, the energy of these two brains colliding, and they would have been empty. They would have had nothing in them at all. The energy is converted into, you know, energy within each brain. Now, Einstein told us that this famous equation E equals mc squared. So that tells us that mass is a form of energy. So this energy could actually have been used, the energy of the collision could be used to conjure mass out of nothing, create all the matter in the universe, which became the galaxies and everything like that. So this is an interesting idea. Then it turns out that it could be that these collisions occur, you know, the two brains collide, they go through each other, they create big bangs in each brain, and then maybe the universe has come back again and you get another big bang and another big bang. But the subtle difference is here, you get big bangs followed by big bangs. You don't get big crunches, big bangs, big crunches, big bangs, big crunches. So there's a subtle difference here. And there's quite a lot of excitement about this idea because it does actually predict something different from the standard picture of our universe, which is what's called Big Bang plus inflation. So it does make a prediction about things called gravity waves, gravitational waves, which we haven't yet detected, but we're hoping to be able to detect within the next few years. So it might be possible to tell whether this idea is true. But at least that gives us an explanation of what the Big Bang was.
Marcus, do you remember when we were kids, people used to tell us that maybe we were living on a little flea on a dog, or you know, we were all on a small little atom, and there were zillions of us. Do you think that's possible? Could we be so minute that whatever we're on is something a little larger, but it's on just a massive object?
Well, that's never occurred to me. But of course, what we're actually discovering as we learn more about the universe is that it just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, if you could go back to the beginning of the 20th century, we didn't even know that the Milky Way, this big collection of stars, 100 billion stars or whatever, you know, we thought that was all there was. You know, then we learned that, in fact, the Milky Way is just one among maybe 100 billion other galaxies. So the universe got tremendously bigger. Now we're talking about beyond the horizon of the universe, there being, you know, vast, vast, vastly greater regions of the universe beyond the horizon, you know, perhaps, you know, infinite amount. And then when we begin to think about parallel universes, you know, the possibility that our universe is not alone and there may be other domains as well, other universe, cosmic domains, we're just getting smaller and smaller and smaller. The universe is getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And, you know, we're just getting smaller and smaller. We're shrinking. So I don't know. Who knows? You know, maybe your speculation is right.
So do you bring God at all into the equation on any of this?
I don't, but, you know, I mean, it's possible. It's always possible. The thing is that that's not a scientific thing, you see. If you say, well, God created everything...
It's an easy answer.
yeah.
God did it.
I mean, one of the interesting things, I mean, take people like Newton. They were very religious. Newton was very, very religious. But Newton thought that in actually understanding the universe, he was actually seeing the mind of the Creator. So he never saw any conflict himself. You know, he thought, well, either there, you know, I mean, if look, we've got, there's two possibilities. Either there isn't a God, in which case, it's just a fantastic universe. We live in this fantastic universe. If there is a God, well, he's made a fantastic universe. I mean, it doesn't seem to make much difference, really.
Well, yeah, but here's a big question for you. You know, and you've studied science way longer than I have. How could all this have happened? How could we be who we are, what we are, by just a roll of the dice, by just an accident, by a fluke?
Well, certainly, you know, if you take, for instance, the evolution of life on Earth, it hasn't been a fluke because natural selection is takes the roll of the dice, and it actually exploits that. So it isn't, you know, we haven't.
I mean, there's order to this, Marcus. There's science. There's a plan because things here seem to work.
Say that, ask me that question again.
Well, I said there's order to all of this. It's not like a mistake. It's not like, you know, you put 20 marbles in a hat, you shake them up and throw them out, and they all end up being in the right spot. There's more to it.
Absolutely, but that's what's so exciting. You know, there are definitely laws of physics that we haven't discovered. I mean, you know, there is so much more that we haven't actually discovered. You know, I mean, every stage we see how the universe is put together, and we're just stunned by how fantastically elegant and beautiful it is. And we're learning new things all the time. And these kind of questions, you know, you're asking about how could it all come about, these are the really, really big questions in physics, and the questions that we would just love to be able to answer. And we're getting close to answer it as well. I mean, you know, I can phrase it in another way. Why is there something rather than nothing? That is the biggest cosmological question of all. You know, why isn't there just nothing? How come there's this complex universe around us? But, you know, one of the interesting things we've discovered is that we can actually, if we start with the Big Bang, we know what the temperature and the conditions were in the Big Bang because we can actually see the fireball radiation. It's all around us, and it brings us information about those early times. And we can only then we can run forward in our minds with our theories in our computers. We can run forward the evolution of the universe, and what we see happening is the formation of galaxies, the formation of stars and planets, exactly as we see. So the laws of physics do appear to explain what we see around us. It doesn't seem to be any supernatural power. We don't really need that. But, of course, when you get back to the very beginning, you know, why is there something rather than nothing? Who knows? That may not be a scientific question. It may not be possible to answer that question within the realm of science.
Is there any – I want to get personal for a moment because it'll give me a better opportunity to understand where you're coming from. Is there any special religion within you?
There isn't, no. I mean, I don't have a problem with that, really, because I just think, you know, isn't the universe fantastic? And I can live with doubt, you know. I can live with knowing that there are many, many things about the universe that I don't know and that I will never know in my lifetime, you know.
All right.
And that doesn't really worry me at all. In fact, that kind of excites me. It means there's a lot out there to discover, a lot to understand. I get meaning from my life, from the relationships that I have with my family and my friends and whatever. And it doesn't worry me at all that there are lots of things that I don't know. In fact, yeah, as I say, I mean, I remember the American physicist Richard Feynman was very good on this. And he said that he, you know, he was okay with not knowing, you know, it didn't bother him.
Well, and you're honest about it, which I appreciate as well. How about life after death? A believer in that? A soul, a spirit, that perhaps it goes someplace else, maybe another dimension, maybe another universe.
I have no idea. I mean, once again, I just say these things are unlikely. You know, I mean, it could be proved wrong, but it does appear to be slightly unlikely. I mean, my dad died in 1999, about 7 years ago now, and I've not had any sign whatsoever from my dad. And, you know, I love my dad. My dad loved me. If it was possible, if there was a life after death, I'm sure he would have tried to communicate. So, you know, my wife is actually a terminal care nurse, so she deals with dying people, people with cancer, people with motor neuron disease.
Is she a believer?
No. Although she has said odd things about, for instance, when people die. You know, she says that you actually know that they've died, even if they're in another room. Something does change. Something does happen. It could be that you're finally tuned in to, you know, you listen to people's breathing or something like that at some kind of level, and you notice when that stops. But it's interesting that when one of her patients dies, she will know even when she's not in the room. So if you think that's maybe a soul leaving the body, maybe that's correct.
Well,
I don't know. But
it's funny, Marcus, because we differ, but we're also close on some views as well. But I do believe in the hereafter. Hey, let's take some phone calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM.